Christ's departure from and reunion with his disciples. So he's going to make it clear that he is going to depart, but that he is going to come back to them. And they're not going to understand a lot of this right now. And it's going to be quite a shock, as we know, that when he does come back from the dead. He also tells them, as we'll get into, Lord willing, eventually chapter 14, he's going to give them an insight as to where they would eventually be going, which, you know, that created misunderstanding among some of them as far as the whole concept of heaven. So, his departure and reunion with them, and within this particular section, notice verses 31 and 32, in Jesus' discussion concerning his glory, he says, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him immediately." So now you'll notice that I put Jesus was glorified, and you're thinking, why isn't Jesus is glorified? That's how, you know, perhaps your translation has Jesus, you know, the Son of Man is glorified. Well, the reason why is because this is going to capture better the Greek text. Jesus was glorified, but I'll come back to this. But first, I just want to give more of an outline of this particular section. Then you're going to have the new commandment, and we're going to see that the new commandment is the commandment of love. And then we'll see Peter's confidence and Jesus' warning, particularly warning to Peter. And then you're going to have chapter 15 through chapter 16, the loving relationship between Christ and his disciples. So this covers 13:31 through 16:33. Now back to what we're talking about here in chapter 13, 31 and 32. Jesus was glorified. Now notice, prior to this, you have chapter 12, verse 23. You have the hour has come. And the perfect tense is used in the Greek text. And New King James actually captures that. Jesus answered them saying, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified." So you have the perfect tense. Now remember in our brief discussions of the perfect tense that the perfect tense is used actually so rarely within the Greek New Testament that when it is used, you should pay attention to it. It is significant. The perfect tense is significant. And it is with purpose. And the reason why is because the perfect tense is an action that occurred in the past with continuing effects to the present. So that whatever was done in the past continues in full force and full effect to the present hour. And we have a harder time perhaps grasping that in English. But the hour has come. And that's the weight of the perfect tense, the Greek perfect tense. Now notice though, 13:31, you don't have the perfect tense. You have the aorist passive, which the best way really to capture the aorist, simply to our way of thinking, is, you know, an action that occurred in the past. And pretty much leaves it at that. Passive, of course, that's why, not that Jesus is glorified or just he was, it's passive. He was glorified. Jesus was glorified. He didn't glorify himself. So it's not active, it's passive. Our translations, there's only, and I'll point out one or two that do actually capture this concept of was glorified. The reason why we talk about this is showing that, well, the hour has come. It is in full force, full effect, and now, shortly after that, you have this terminology of as though it's already accomplished. Why? Because it was so certain. Jesus, just as certainly as now Judas, and I think this is all within this concept, Judas had certainly made up his mind. He was bent on this. Actually, even we find the terminology of Satan enter, verse 27, 13:27. After the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Judas is dead set on his mission, on his course of action. It's not to serve God and follow God and follow Christ. He is doing the work of the devil. And Jesus is just as bent on absolutely doing the will of the Father. For this whole purpose, he has come. And so, Jesus can say that he was glorified. Verse 31, 32. Now the Son of Man was glorified, and God is glorified in him. So what you have then is this terminology that it's so certain in Jesus' mind that this glorification is going to take place that it's as though it's already accomplished. And so, then, this is Young's Literal Translation, YLT, Young's Literal Translation. Some of you may be familiar with Young's Literal Translation, an old, solid, far more literal translation. It's far more literal than even what is held as the most woodenly literal of the modified literal versions, meaning the 1901 American Standard. This is Young's Literal Translation, and notice he says, now was the Son of Man glorified, and God was glorified in him. So both the aorist passive are used in both occasions. Was the Son of Man glorified, and God was glorified. So, and usually we would not separate, and you really wouldn't do, you wouldn't separate the was and glorified even in a literal translation. Why? Because it's not a matter of separating these words. That's inherent within this aorist passive, is was glorified. So it would be, now was glorified the Son of Man, or now the Son of Man was glorified. Notice then, and then there's another one, I think it's the DLNT, the Disciples Literal New Testament. I don't know that I cited that. I thought I may have. But Disciples Literal New Testament, I believe, also has this concept of was glorified. Also notice, concerning this concept, that Jesus' heart was so set on doing the Father's will that his mission was as good as accomplished. Chapter 17, particularly verses 4 and 5. But let's back up to even verse 1, because you have this whole concept of glorification. Jesus says, Father, the hour has come, which reminds us of chapter 12, verse 23. Glorify your Son, that your Son also may glorify you, as you have given him authority over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as you have given him. Verses 3 and 4, and this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. Verse 4, I have glorified you on the earth. Now, so you have Jesus' request that the Father will glorify him. But then you have, I have glorified you on the earth. I have finished the work which you have given me to do. And now, O Father, glorify me together with yourself with the glory with which I had with you before the world was. And so, had he completely, absolutely finished all the work? No, not yet, but it's as good as having been accomplished. Because ultimately, Jesus on the cross, before he dies, what does he say? It is finished. And that word finished is, it is accomplished. It is completed. It is complete. What? Everything, the work that he, his whole mission, the work that he was sent to do, and the redemptive scheme. Notice then the next few verses, verses 33 through 35. Now we come to what we could call the new commandment. John chapter 13, 33 through 35. He says, little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give to you, that you should love one another, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. So the new commandment. We could say that this is a it's a new commandment that was also an old commandment, couldn't we? The commandment to love is not new in that sense, but we need to look at this a little bit more. And let's walk through this. First of all, Jesus uses the terminology little children. Now, you're going to see that John will use this terminology in the book of 1 John as well. Little children, notice the only time that the technical word would be diminutive, technia, which is for child, is the only time that this is used in this account. Why? Because it's a reference to not just children, but little children. We really wouldn't say small children, but little children. It is an endearing term. But notice, as we suggested, it's used seven times in 1 John. Let's look at these occurrences. 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. The only time we might see it occur in John, but notice, as we start looking at these, and it's good to do a more comprehensive study of a term like this, especially when you have John use it so much, particularly in his writing to people, but who introduced him to this concept? Well, no doubt, Jesus did. 1 John chapter 2, verse 1, "My little children, these things I write to you, so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous." So, my little children. Some of your translations may say, "my dear children." Some may take far more liberty, my dearly loved ones. But technically, it would be little children. Notice 2 verse 12 of chapter 2. "I write to you, little children, because your sins are forgiven you for His name's sake." Verse 28. "And now, little children, abide in Him, that when He appears, we may have confidence and not be ashamed before Him at His coming." So, three times in chapter 2. Then notice chapter 3, verse 7. "Little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he is righteous." Then 3:18. "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue." Some of our translations. "Let us not love in word or in speech, but in deed and in truth, in action and in truth." And those may be better translations. Chapter 4, verse 4. "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." And notice that even the terminology little children, well, we don't think of little children being powerful and mighty, and yet, "you are of God, little children, and have overcome them." Little children overcoming. We don't usually think of little children overcoming anything, do we? I mean, that's the way they viewed David versus Goliath. And what did they tell David? Even though David was not a wee little boy David, as sometimes we may have sang in our VBS, as best we can tell, he may have likely been 21 years old or thereabouts. You didn't go to war unless you were 20, did you? You remember the numbering? And, well, David is apparently a young man. And what did they tell him? "You are a youth, and he," Goliath, "is what? Has been a man of war from his youth." But we don't think of, you know, somebody like David would be able to overcome. But with God, he did overcome him. And so similarly, as we look at this here in 1 John 4, verse 4, "You are of God, little children, and have overcome them." And the reason why is not because you are who you are, you're little children, but because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. Then chapter 5, verse 21, which we just mentioned a while ago, "Little children," he ends on this note, "keep yourselves from idols." Amen. So he ends it on this term of endearment. And it's used only one other time. Technia is used only one other time in the New Testament. Galatians 4, verse 19 by Paul. Let's turn to that. And it is a tender appeal. So, outside of 1 John, two other occurrences in the New Testament. One in the account of John, and here in Galatians chapter 4, verse 19, Paul says, "My little children, for whom I labor in birth again until Christ is formed in you." So that helps us to understand that when Jesus does use this term, it's significant. It's a very endearing term that is used outside of 1 John. It's used so sparingly that it's only two other times. Notice then, at the Last Supper, Jesus, as we recall that setting where Jesus is in the place of honor, the second seat on the left, if we have it correct, Jesus filled the role of head of the family and the disciples. The disciples are filling the role as children. Children whose function was to do what? Ask him questions that brought out the significance of the occasion. So if we think about the family unit, the children would ask questions. As I understand, they would ask questions when they would sit, and here Jesus fills that role as the head of the family, and he is. He's answering their questions, and he is talking to them as the father figure. And so it makes sense then that Jesus, as the head, and isn't that interesting too about the terminology we later see, that Christ is the head of the church. And so he says, little children, I will be with you only a little while longer. Then, as we continue, notice this new commandment. As we stated, the command to love, it's not a new commandment. And we can establish that it's not a new commandment, you know, as we think of new, in that we can go to passages. Let's go to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6:5. And the Hebrew mind frame knew this, knew it well, because Deuteronomy 6, particularly verses 4 and following, were well quoted. Hear, O Israel, verse 4, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Of course, we're familiar with other passages that quote this, and Jesus says that the first and great commandment is this very passage in Matthew 22:37-39. And of course, he also tells us the next one, Leviticus 19:18, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That is the second great commandment. And Jesus says on these two hang all the law and the prophets. So love your neighbor as yourself. And I mentioned already Matthew 22:37-39. Now notice also Mark, as we parallel what we have in the Old Testament with what we have here in Matthew and in Mark 12, verses 28-33. Mark 12:28-33. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second like it is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And then, back to the book of Galatians, you have Galatians chapter 5, verse 4. Notice what Paul says, and appropriately so, because they were in the process of devouring one another because of this lack of love. He had told them, verse 13, through love serve one another. Then notice what he says, Galatians 5, verse 14, For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Then he tells them, verse 15, But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. So the command to love, it's not new. So what was new? What was new when Jesus says, A new commandment I give to you? It's the command to love as Jesus loved. Let's go back and look at John 13, because Jesus says, A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, but notice the rest of that. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. That's what's new. He's not saying, hey, you know, you've never heard this command before to love, but I'm telling you, you got to love. No, it's a matter of what some would call the degree of love, to love as Jesus loved and to the extent of love. Now, what does that mean then? Well, we have when we think about Leviticus 19, 18, to love your neighbor as yourself, it does not mean, in Leviticus 19, 18, that you have to love your neighbor more than yourself. But now, Jesus gave his life. So, is Jesus loving his neighbor even more than himself? He gave his life. And so now we have this intensification, if you will, of love. This degree of love, the command to love as Jesus loved. Notice that Jesus clearly is adding a depth, you can say a new depth of meaning to love, the intensity, to an extreme degree. Let's go to 1 John 2, verses 7 and 8. 1 John chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. We make a lot of parallels, as we have been with 1 John, because John, who records for us the account of John, that's why a study of, you know, John, as we've been doing, lays such a solid foundation for 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and the book of Revelation. 1 John 2, 7 and 8. Brothers, and then some of your translations are going to read beloved instead of brothers here. Brothers, I write no new commandment to you, but an old commandment, which you have had from the beginning. The old commandment is the word which you heard from the beginning. And we've, I think, talked just briefly at least about the beginning. For John, the beginning that he's talking about in a lot of these occurrences, or some of these occurrences, is the beginning of the gospel, the beginning of having heard the gospel. He's not talking about the beginning of time, because obviously they weren't there in the beginning of time and they didn't hear it from the beginning, but they heard it from, kind of like Mark says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So, the beginning of the gospel. So, the old commandment is the word which you have heard from the beginning. Verse 8, again, a new commandment I write to you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. I believe it is already pretty much to be understood that we know something about what Jesus has said about this new commandment, and that that therefore serves as background for an understanding of, hey, we've got to love as Jesus loved. And along these lines, which I'll reference it here in a bit, but go ahead, since we're here in 1 John, 1 John 3, verse 16. 1 John 3, verse 16, by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought, some of your translations may render it as, it can be, must, lay down our lives for the brothers. It's not a matter of, well, we, you know, it's optional. That's not the way this is, the Greek text is here. It's not like, well, you know, it's optional. This is, we are obligated. And that is actually, as I worked out my translation on this, we are obligated to lay down our lives for the brethren. My understanding and the research I did on this, it is the best word, you know, to capture. Ought, you know, if we say, well, you ought to do that, that doesn't mean you have to. But if you say you're obligated to do that, this is our duty. And 1 John 3:16, for me, and I think for many, if not most of us, this is one of the most difficult, most challenging verses in the Bible. Because if we really understand this, you know, you get to thinking, kind of like we've talked about in Romans chapter 5, for scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man will someone dare to die, but God demonstrates his own love toward us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than having now been justified by his blood, we will be saved from wrath through him. Well, Christ died for sinners. Christ died for the ungodly. Romans 5 or 6, Christ died for us. So, we are obligated to lay down our lives for the brothers. So, this new commandment, to love as Jesus loved. So, when we talk about to love as Jesus loved, chapter 15, verse 13, Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. There is no greater love. It's unfortunate, and I believe that some have applied this to military conquest. I know that there have been some brothers, at least in the past, that have tried to apply this and say, you know, when we when we go to war, and they even apply it to unbelievers and say, well, you know, it's going to die on behalf of God and country, and so there's no greater love because they gave themselves in self-sacrifice. That's not what Jesus has in mind. You know, later on, it's clear Jesus doesn't have military conquest, and the way to lay down your life is to go and fight to the death. Jesus makes it clear, John 18:36, my kingdom is not of this world. But if my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. So we, I believe, it is complete misapplication of John 15:13. Not sure if we have the song even, but if I should die upon a foreign field someday. It was pointed out to me years ago by one member of the church that thought that that song in it very well may have meant all along, and that, you know, hey, you know, I might sign up for war and I go to defend our country and I die upon a foreign field someday, but it's no less than love demands, no less than I can repay, and greater love has no, you know, if you know that song. And if that's the case, then that's completely missing what Jesus is actually saying. Jesus is talking about he's giving his life and there is no greater love. John makes the application that we also, there's no greater love than we lay down our lives for the sake of the brothers. So, John 15, verse 13. Notice, we mentioned 1 John 3, verse 16 already. Interestingly, as we do a little bit of research, Tertullian says in his apology, the pagans of his day, which was about a century after John's account was written, he says that the pagans remarked of Christians, see how they love one another and how ready they are to die for one another. Do we love like Jesus loved? Do we love like they loved? That's why 1 John 3, verse 16, I do believe it's one of the most challenging. You know, a lot of times we talk about difficult passages in the New Testament. I don't know how many put this on their radar, but for me, that's one of them. We're going to have to stop here. Our time is gone. But when we look at this, verse 13:35, we are to be known by loving one another. And if we're not known for our love, then are we really the disciples of Jesus? By this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. So John 13:35, that's why it is so significant. We're to be known by love. People are to know us by the love that we have for one another. It's clear about a century after John wrote that, some followers of Christ were doing an exceptional job. How ready they are to die for one another. If you're here today and if we can help in any of your spiritual needs, would you come as we stand, as we sing?